What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
There's something about spring that just feels like a reset. Longer days, fresh energy, and the motivation to try something new. This spring, that something new could be learning a new language. That's where Rosetta Stone comes in. They've been a leader in language learning for over 30 years with an immersive method that helps you learn naturally, connecting words, visuals, and meaning in context instead of memorizing or translating. With over 25 languages to choose from, like Spanish, French, German, even Japanese, Rosetta Stone is a go-to tool for real language learning. It's designed to help you think in your new language so what you learn actually sticks. Plus, True Accent gives real-time feedback on your pronunciation so you sound more natural, like having a personal coach. And you can learn anytime, anywhere, whether you've got 5 minutes or a full hour. Ready to start learning a new language this spring? Visit rosettastone.com/today to explore Rosetta Stone and choose the language that's right for you. Go to rosettastone.com/today now and begin your language learning journey.
We're so excited to be playing our interview with Randy Bryce, or Iron Stash as he's known on Twitter. Randy Bryce is a U.S. Army veteran and a union iron worker, and he joined the race for Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District, where he'll be challenging Paul Ryan. He talks to us about his time in the U.S. Army, being posted in Honduras, becoming skeptical of U.S. foreign policy. He also reveals to us his interesting ethnic background. Then we talk to Karina Moreno, a professor and immigration and securitization expert who teaches at LIU. She talks to us about her Jacobin article, The Politics of Solidarity, how Muslim and Latinos can work together. Subscribe to our Patreon because we have a really great bonus for you today. We play this ridiculous setup interview that CNN did with Randy Bryce, where they ask him a very stupid gotcha question. We also play Randy's response to that clip and what he learned from doing media like that. And then we talk to Adam Johnson, a journalist who writes for places like FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and The Nation, and he analyzes what CNN and other networks do in order to discredit programs like Single Payer. And he gives really great tips on what to do in those situations, how to respond to gotcha questions from corporate media. So it's extremely useful. And to do that, just go to patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. And make sure you follow us on Twitter. The hashtag is KTHelpShow. That's letter K, letter T, HALPSHOW. My handle is KTHelps, and Gabe's is Gabe_Pacheco. Please make sure you rate and review us on iTunes. Follow us on SoundCloud. And we'll be resuming our live shows in front of an audience at the Brooklyn Commons in September. Hello and welcome to the Katie Halper Show. I'm your host, Katie Halper. And if it's a Wednesday, you can always hear the Katie Halper Show. And you know where you hear that show? You hear it on WBAI 99.5 FM or WBAI.org. And in the studio, of course, I'm with Reggie Johnson, the engineer-in-chief, the EIC.
Hey, Katie.
Hey, Reggie. We have a great show for you today. We are going to be talking to Karina Moreno, who's a professor who writes about immigration. She's going to be talking about the politics of solidarity and about what Muslim Americans or Muslims and Latino Americans or Latinos have to do. You know what? It's like Tina Turner asked, what's Muslims got to do with it, or what's Latinos got to do, but a second class citizenship. You're welcome, everyone. I just came up with that. That's pretty good, right? Reggie, you like that?
That was last minute?
Yeah, I swear to God.
Wow, you astound me.
I know, right?
Wow. I'm bedazzled.
Yeah, bedazzled. Exactly. That's bedazzled, if I can definitely get a bedazzled out of Reggie, then my bedazzled life's work is done. But you guys, I didn't want to announce it because I wanted to make sure. I didn't want to get people's hopes up if we were going to be disappointing them. But you guys, guess who we have on coming on right now? You may have heard of him. His Twitter handle is Iron Stash, and his real name is Randy Bryce, and he is going to be challenging Paul Ryan. Yes. So, Mr. Stash, are you there?
How are you doing, Katie?
Good. Thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure.
You made a real splash with your campaign ad that you released, which is really moving, and you talk about your kind of struggles with healthcare. You talk about your work as an iron worker.
My mom is probably the most important person in my life. She was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis.
It's a very painful condition. It's like hot knives going through, and you can't talk, you can't swallow. It's terrible. I'm on 20 drugs, and if I don't take the one that costs them thousands of dollars, I don't know what would happen.
The system is extremely flawed. I work every day so that me and my son have insurance. I've been an iron worker for 20 years. I work hard, and I earn every penny that I make. And I know everybody that I work with is the same way. I've spent my entire life in southeastern Wisconsin. I can see what people need. I could do so much more, and I will do so much more, taking my voice, taking our voice, and what we need to Washington, D.C. I decided to run for office because not everybody's seated at the table, and it's time to make a bigger table. I'm the best person to represent this district because I'm a working person. If somebody falls behind, we're so much stronger if we carry them with us. That's the way I was raised. You look out for each other. I think it's time, let's trade places. Paul Ryan, you can come work the iron, and I'll go to DC. We can do so much better together as a community, and our future depends on it.
You're basically the thing that politicians pretend to be, in my humble opinion. Can you, and I know a lot of people have asked you this question, but I just want listeners to know, can you talk about what inspired you to get involved and to run?
Sure. I volunteered some years back, just under 10 years ago, our international, I'm a member of the Ironworkers Union, I belong to Ironworkers Local 8. Our international thought it was very important to get more involved with political issues, and I had been going to local city council meetings and things like that, trying to help get projects pushed, because I knew that being involved on a very local level, that helped us go to work, that helped our members of brothers and sisters in my local get work. So I volunteered, and it was a volunteer position to be political coordinator. A few years after that, I mean, it was pretty just, you know, generic, basic things, keeping in contact with local politicians, helping endorse them, the ones that were good on labor issues. And then comes, 2011, and Scott Walker he wins the election for governor. And then I pretty much just dove into the deep end of the pool. Had been very involved with Act 10. Even though I belong to a private sector union in the billing trades, I knew it was just a matter of time based on what he did, his actions that were against the county workers when he was county executive. I knew it was just a matter of time. I didn't trust men. So I became as involved as I possibly could. And I went up to Madison to do laps around the Capitol every weekend. And even during the week, I took off time from work. So, I mean, it was a big deal. It was very important. It was very moving to be a part of all of that. And then people in the district called, especially, I mean, a lot of people became much more active with, we have a Forward Kenosha, a Forward Racine group, indivisible groups that are coming up, and just a lot more people wanting, feeling like they want to get more actively involved with what's going on since Donald Trump won his election. So there were, people had been calling me and leaving messages, Randy, why don't you think about running? And I was at the point for a long time, I was like, well, it's flattering that you're asking me, thanks. But I'm not saying no right now. We'll see what goes on. I had some people from the Working Families Party approach me, and they're like, we're looking for somebody to run against Paul Ryan. Would you be interested? It got a little bit more serious at that point. And then on the May Day march, I marched with BOSIS, which is like the largest immigrant rights group in the state. And I mean, they can put out tens of thousands of people for some actions, and it's just phenomenal. So I was asked if I'd participate with that, and I said, absolutely. And so I did that, and I ran into a state senator, Senator Larson, who came up to me, and he started doing the pitch about, you know, I know somebody that really would like to get rid of Paul Ryan. There's some people talking. We want to, you know, dying to support somebody that we think can pull it off. This is going to be the time to take them out. Is it okay if I forward your information? So I was like, yeah, I guess you can. It wouldn't hurt to talk. And that's kind of where I ended up getting it was pretty much no looking back.
Right.
No turning back.
You jumped in. Now, I one of the people who's written about you a lot early on is Mike Elk, who writes a lot about labor. Now, I didn't know this until I read this piece. He opens his piece saying, at Payday Report, he says, despite his 6'2" frame, the half-Mexican, half-Polish Army veteran known as the Iron Stash on Twitter is the epitome of a gentle giant. Does that make you an arroz con kielbasa if you're Polish-Mexican? And you can use that if that helps you with any demographic. That could really make a big difference.
Well, my biological father, his dad was born in Mexico. And what happened, I mean, I don't know him. Mm-hmm. And if you walk by me on the street, I wouldn't recognize him. So my mom raised me as a single mom for like the first 5 years. And then she remarried. And my dad, who, I mean, I consider him my dad for all intents and purposes.
Sure.
I took his last name. He adopted me.
Got it.
So biologically, there's another guy too, a couple other guys that I know that have the same biological ancestry. We call ourselves Polakins.
Oh, Polakins. I like it.
Polakins.
Okay.
Not to be confused with Puerto Ricans.
Right.
That's another.
Totally different genre. Right.
Right.
Right. One of my best friends is Blaxican, and I have another best friend who's a pizza bagel. You know, we're in New York City, so that's pretty common. And then they're also, I call this, I made this up, this name up. It's a potato famine latke. That's Irish Jewish. Anyway, all these demographics are going to definitely be supporting you.
Good.
And, you know, we at this station we're very left. And, Mr. Bryce, I think that our listeners would really like to call, or should I call you Iron? What should I call
Randy.
You? Okay, Randy.
Randy.
Okay. Thanks. I think our listeners would be really interested. I was speaking to Mike Elk about you, and he was telling me about some really fascinating background that you have in terms of foreign policy based on your experience in Central America.
Mm-hmm.
And I think our listeners, again, who are very, you know, we're kind of like, we make NPR look like Fox News. So I think our listeners would be very interested in hearing about that experience. And what changed when you did through your experience there?
Well, I entered the Army in the mid 80s, and I was going to be, my intent, my dad's a retired Milwaukee police officer, and my intent was kind of following his footsteps. I went in to be an NP, and
that's a military, not member of parliament, but military police.
Right, military police.
Sorry, yeah.
Correct. So I did that. And originally I was supposed to be stationed at White Sands Missile Range. So they pulled, you know, quite an extensive security check on me. And I went to go, you know, report in for duty. And I was told that I was being diverted to Fort Bragg, North Carolina. So I then ended up going there. And I was part of the Rapid Deployment Forces with like the 18th Airborne Corps there, 82nd Airborne is stationed there. A lot of, you know, special forces, gung-ho, very gung-ho base for the most part. And then I was deployed to Honduras for a period of time. And this was when, I mean, Ronald Reagan was the president, and it had been just after Grenada. My unit was coming back from Grenada, and they had the Sandinistas were in power in Nicaragua, and the Contras were just on the other side of the Nicaraguan border. They were in Honduras. And then there was a lot of stuff going on in El Salvador too, and a lot of it I didn't find out until after I left.
Right.
I spent time there pretty much doing security for, we were at a place called the Secret Square where, information was taken from, you know, around the area along the border, and it was all processed where I was. And I got to talk to some of the people there, especially this one guy who was responsible for turning the water on for us to take a shower.
Hmm.
And, talking to him, I got to find out more about what his thoughts were on living there. And I mean, it was genuinely a banana republic. And yeah. I felt really horrible. Like I wanted to take this guy, you know, sneak him on a plane with us coming back up. Cause that was, I mean, his job, he got basically nothing for just spending all day there, turning on the water for a couple hours in the middle of the day and then going home. They had, I mean, nothing. And then, like, we'd go into town, too, and there were groups of kids that would come up, like, try to shine your shoes for, a dollar or something, almost nothing, just so they could get something to eat. These are, you know, street kids. So I picked one who he just had, like, really large ears. And he was, you know, the other kids kind of picked on him and pushed him away, and his name was George. So I saw him off to the side, and I was like, hey, you know, so I got to meet George. And every time I went into town, I looked for George. And he was probably about a couple years older than my son is now, I guess, like around 11, 12. So, I mean, we took him out, me and the guy I was on guard duty with. And, I mean, we did as good as we could, you know, to make his existence more bearable and to kind of put up, you know, like, we're from the United States and not everybody is bad. And, we're here to help people out. And that's why, you know, I went down there and I fully felt that that's what our mission was down there. And then after going back to the States, after being down there, it was just, I wasn't gung ho, and it got to the point where I was really, I wanted to finish my enlistment, and I wasn't planning on signing up for another term. But I was looking forward to getting back to civilian life. And so I did. And when I got out, one of the first jobs I had was working with homeless veterans.
Hmm.
And it was a federal grant called the Homeless Veterans Reintegration Project. So what we did at that time, the homeless population, 60% of the homeless population was made up of veterans.
Wow.
And that was just, I mean, when I heard that number and I was asked about the job, I'm like, yeah. And I took it. I didn't ask what it paid and it turned out to be, you know, the pay was very minimal. But still, it was just the job that I, you know, one of those jobs you live for and you feel you have a sense of purpose. And the goal of that project was to take all the veterans we could identify in the city of Milwaukee and get them involved in services that were specific, like through the VA, any kind of veterans projects that we could. And that way it would free up money and resources for the rest of the homeless population.
Mm.
And, you know, that ran its course for a couple of years. Some good things came out as a result. Like there's a, down in Racine now, there's a apartment complex that's named after one of the guys that ran the project. But part of that, doing that and talking to the veterans, was we ran into one guy who was, he's like, I'm an atomic soldier. And I was like, well, what's that? And he pulled up his shirt, and it looked like somebody poured acid all over his back. And I was like, my God, what happened to you? And he was like, I was one of the guys that was at the test site when they tested a nuclear bomb. And I mean, it was like, what do you say to somebody like that? Because, you know, he's homeless. How are we going to get proof that this happened to the guy? There was no other explanation for what I saw. I'd never seen anything like it before. But so it was trying to, you know, contact the VA. I'm like, look, there's this guy. He he says this happened to him. And then they were like, well, we need some kind of documentation. I'm like, this guy's homeless. What can I, you know, and it was hard enough then just trying to find, you know, get him hooked up with a job or something. Because if you're homeless, what do you put down? Even if you get them, take them somebody to fill out a job application for where they live. We eventually got the shelters to allow us to use their address as like a home address. And, you know, they would relay messages. But the homeless population was just, you couldn't find them. So eventually I lost track of this man, without being able to help him. And it's, you know, to this day, I'm wondering whatever became of him. And that really has me very upset when I see something going on as far as, you know, like cuts to veterans. Because I honestly feel that veterans have no use to a particular group of people in the country unless we're catching bullets for them. Because right. Once we get back, they don't want to. And it's not just physical well-being, but especially mental well-being. I mean,
yeah, how do you think that Republicans, how is it that Republicans have managed to convince veterans and also workers to support them when their entire, and again, I don't want to pretend that the Democrats are great on this, but mm-hmm. they certainly don't focus as much as the Republicans do on gutting programs for the homeless or for veterans. And as someone who's both, not homeless, for workers and homeless people and veterans, but as someone who's mm-hmm. both a veteran and a worker, how do you think, what insights do you have into how Republicans have managed to attract these people? How someone like Paul Ryan wins in Wisconsin, how someone like Scott Walker wins in Wisconsin, and what is that insight, how does that shape how you're going to move forward to try to win this election?
Well, the thing is when, once upon a time when Paul Ryan did have public town halls in the district, he sounded...
Centuries ago, right?
Pardon me?
Centuries ago, back in the 15th century.
Right.
Yeah.
It's been like 630 some days.
Right.
I think it's been. But when he did show up, he would talk, he sounded like a Democrat. You know, promising older people he's going to protect Social Security and Medicare. And, you know, even recently when they were going through the House to repeal Obamacare, there were commercials being played, you know, and I'm not saying they were attached to his campaign specifically, but some other group that was very supportive of him were playing these commercials that were, you know, call Paul Ryan, thank him for protecting your ability to be covered, you know, to not to get penalized for a pre-existing condition. And I'm looking at the TV and I'm like, holy cow, these guys they're just so brazen now. They're just outright lying. And the thing is that people are starting to understand what he's doing with like the groups that I mentioned before that sort of sprung up after the recent election in November. People are becoming more and more aware. And I honestly think that's part of the reason why he's not here now is because he understands people are upset. And I mean, if you just look around the country where Republicans did go back that voted to take away health care, just the kind of response that they got. So, I mean, I don't really blame him, but, you know, at the same time, like for me, if I don't show up on a job site and weld what needs to get welded or put some iron together, if I don't do that, if I don't show up, they're going to replace me with somebody who will do it.
Right.
So he's doing stuff. He's taking stuff away from us, you know, and it's not lost. It's not misplaced. He's actively trying to take this away from us, our ability to see a doctor. And I'm really, it's really upsetting, especially, looking at my mom, what that'll mean for, you know, people like my mom who depends on her medication, not just to be healthy, but that's her independence. That's her ability to go to the grocery store on her own. That's her ability to go visit my dad who has Alzheimer's and assisted living. Without her medication, she wouldn't be able to do that.
Right.
So I take what he's doing very personal, and I know I'm not the only one, and especially since we launched our campaign, get, you know, like postcards, letters from people. I'm 85 years old, retired on a fixed income, and you know, bless you for for running against Paul Ryan. I don't have a lot, but here's $5, and I'll be like a $5 bill, and, you know, offers of hers, and I'm like, it really hits me hard when I read letters like that. Just knowing that the story that was told in that video, it's not just me, and it's, you know, when people ask how was it so successful, how did it, what made it blow up, and I'm like, it's just a very common message. It's a basic message. I didn't invent the internet, and it's not an ad or something telling people, look at me, I did this for all of you. It's just telling a story about a working guy who is, you know, how stuff's affecting him, and it's personal, and it's relatable. Obviously been very personal for other people too.
Right. Randy Bryce, thank you so much for joining us, Iron Stash on Twitter, and where can people find you online so they can find out more about your campaign?
www.randybriceforcongress.com. And I'm also on Facebook under Randy Bryce or Iron Stash. And, you know, and I appreciate you reaching out. I just happened to see that you were looking for somebody how to get a hold of me. And I just want to let everybody know, that working people need to run to represent ourselves.
Yes.
So thank you for the invitation.
Thank
I really
you.
Appreciate
and
it.
And say hi to your family, who we know through your ads.
I will.
Okay.
I
thanks
will.
So much.
I will. Thank you. Have a great night.
Thanks, you too. Wow, that was great. That was great. I'm quelling a little bit. That was Randy Bryce, Iron Stash, on Twitter. We're going to transition to our guest who's in studio, and her name is Karina Moreno. She's been on the show before. She's a very accomplished and smart lady. She's a professor. She's a writer. She is going to be talking about this great article she had in Jacobin called The Politics of Solidarity. So, Karina, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
And this is a great piece that you wrote, and what's cool about this piece is that, you know, I have a lot of guests on who are great. They have great politics. They write a lot of think pieces. I do that myself. But you're actually someone who does original research. And so what's really cool about this piece is you get to talk about your own research, interviewing Latinos in Arizona.
Latinos in Arizona and in New York.
So can you talk to us a little bit about what's the thesis of your piece and also about what went into it in terms of research?
So I was part of this big transatlantic comparative research project where we were looking at securitization, which basically means how after 9/11 immigration is framed by political elites as a security threat. So we have been working on this with a grant from Sciences Po and Sorbonne University for years under the Obama administration, looking at data since way before Trump even announced he was running for president. When I was studying security, one of the biggest questions was, why is there this complete lack of awareness between Muslims and Latinos that they're both being targeted in very similar ways and they're both being disproportionately burdened by the state and framed as security threats in a very unfair way that has no merit at all? I feel awful saying this, right? But one of the good things about the Trump presidency is that it finally brought sort of to the forefront and made the connection clear. So before Trump, there was sort of no awareness between the two groups. As soon as Trump took office, though, the hashtag no ban, no wall, no raids, it actually made me really happy because I thought finally this sort of connection can be made. And we began to see Latinos and Muslims do a host of different events together, creating that sort of coalition and that solidarity. Can really be a huge opportunity for the left.
And you write, to play devil's advocate, although it's not really playing devil's advocate because this is in your own piece, Jacobin, you say that data shows that Muslim immigrants are quote-unquote highly assimilated, end quote, compared to other immigrant groups. They complete their naturalization process and acquire citizenship more quickly. For the most part, Muslim immigrants also have socioeconomic status and educational levels comparable to native-born Americans. Latinos are a different story. Sociodemographic data shows that this group consistently lags behind the general population in both socioeconomic status and educational level. Only about 15% of Latinos complete a college education, and the wealth of white households is about 11 times that of a Hispanic household. Latino immigrants acquire citizenship in smaller numbers and at a slower rate than other immigrants. Okay, so my question is, what accounts for these differences, and also what are the similarities despite those differences?
Even though the immigrant experience can be something that they have in common, it's a completely different experience. Muslims, they're generally more educated, more affluent.
So they come here more educated, more affluent, you're saying?
Yes. And they naturalize immediately as soon as they're eligible for it. So when you look at, you compare them with native born Americans, they're actually even better off sociodemographically. So that was something really interesting. I mean, part of the reason why I think there was this lack of awareness between Muslims and Latinos, that they were sort of under the same umbrella of securitization, was because they are demographically so different. Latinos tend to be at the bottom in terms of education, in terms of income, sort of the bottom tier of working people. So, and we still lag behind and are also at the bottom in terms of getting an education, which is not the case for Muslims. So those are the real big differences. The similarities, though, the similarities that now are really glaring under the Trump administration, is that we're both sort of screwed in very similar ways in terms of in terms of being framed as this sort of threat to national security. That's one similarity. And the other one is that we both have low social capital and political capital. You know, it's more of a puzzle when you look at Muslims, because because they're more affluent and more educated, they should have higher social capital, higher political capital, but they don't, because they are stigmatized since 9/11.
Sometimes people look at things like, oh, look, Latinos are less successful, Muslims are more successful, therefore that means there's something culturally wrong with Latinos, or they have this inherent inability to be successful. What is your, how would you respond to that?
When I moved to the United States, I moved to Texas, and I graduated with my bachelor's degree and my master's degree, and I was working at the University of Texas A&M International in Laredo, and I was in charge of this migrant program. So I was in charge of about 40 students who were migrants. So they basically finished the school year a month early so that they could go work with their families on the farms, and then they would start the school year a month late, because then that's when their families would be coming back from their agricultural work. I can say that in my experience, it's been that when when you're just, it's sort of like being trapped in, at the bottom of the labor pool, right? You're sort of just getting by.
Right.
And
also, you don't have to, I mean, when you're coming from a Muslim country, right, you have to take a flight. You can't, like, cross, you can't walk, right? So again, there's going to be a statistical...
Right, and I think, I mean, they have a better education, they have a higher education expectation than us.
Right.
So, I mean, when I was working in this program, we basically tried to set up this first year program to help as much as possible and help them, help these students get through the first year. And so many of them would get phone calls from their parents asking them to come home because they needed help to pay the bills. So this is sort of the lagging effect from generation to generation, that they are not completing a college education. They're sort of staying in this, in the same ring of labor in the service industry. And that's why.
Right. And again, I just think something will happen, right? When you have, when there's a certain financial investment required to go from one country to another, you're going to have a different population, right? Like, coming over. I know it sounds weird because the left doesn't like, I don't mean this in a sociobiological way. I just literally mean, like, the economics that are required to go from one country to another. And I'm not saying, like, all people who flee, who come from Muslim countries are, like, bougie rich people. But there's some kind of capital required.
Yes.
You know, no one really, what's weird about Trump is that I remember when he said, black people, what do you have to lose? And I remember being like, wow, he's good. I'm sorry, but that's like a good, some people were like, I'm sure, like, you're so full of it because you're racist. You wanted to, he does all this dog whistling, right? All his stuff with the Central Park Five, these guys who had their confessions forced out of them. And then they were like compensated by the city because they were, they had, were deprived of due process. And he was really upset about that. He had taken out an ad in the Daily News at the time in the 80s calling for a reinstatement of the death penalty. Like, people get that this was race baiting, right? This is dog whistling. But unlike Mexicans and Muslims, when it came to black people, when it came to LGBTQ, he didn't explicitly attack them the way he did with Mexicans and Muslims, right? Mexicans were rapists and Muslims were terrorists. So that, in a way, was a great unifying thing that happened to them, right? As opposed to black people and LGBTQ people. LGBTQ people he praised.
So this is where I talk about in the Jacobin piece. This is an opportunity for the Democrats, right? So we have a space, hopefully, for actual left politics, because you have groups of people who have traditionally not been active politically, who have not been active participants in terms of voting and any sort of like political process. So you have these groups building a political consciousness right now under Trump. And it's going to be, you know, it's up in the air if the Democrats actually take advantage of that and actually build coalitions that bring these people in. But in the long run, I can't say enough, it will end up hurting the left if the Democrats don't have something to offer Mexicans and Muslims, for example, right? And I'm not just limiting the conversation to them, but I'm saying groups that traditionally don't participate and are becoming more aware of these political things under Trump, it will end up hurting the left so much more in the long term if they don't bring them in as voters for the left.
Which means that if history is any indication, they will not do that, right? Because the left is great. The non-left left, the liberal left is great at doing the antithesis of what they should be doing.
So you have these groups building political consciousness. If the left does not do something to bring them in, what's going to happen is these groups will just be frustrated, withdraw, and will leave like the whole political sphere. Who knows for how long? And that's why I'm saying long term, it will end up hurting left politics much more, because they will not come back. So much of my research has been on the sort of disillusionment that exists already within Latinos and the Democratic Party. So, you know, even the Obama administration, we look at the sort of piecemeal executive orders that he passed, and they were all sort of made on the assumption that Hillary would win the election, right, and that they would continue. But now we have this DACA program, Deferred Action for Child Arrivals. So we essentially have all the Dreamers up in the air in limbo. And essentially in applying for that 2-year protection under Obama, now the Trump administration has all of their information. And that's just the largest betrayal.
Right.
That you can imagine. So, like I said, unless the Democrats really do something here in terms of legalizing people who have been here, people who are here undocumented, who over half of them, maybe I think about like 80% of them have been here for over a decade. And definitely 80% of them are in mixed status families, meaning that, you know, one of the parents has no papers, but the rest of the family is legal. So unless they really do something in terms of immigration, in terms of the security state, the surveillance state of Muslims, then these groups will sort of just withdraw and alienate and not participate politically.
It reminds me of, we did a, listeners should make sure they listen to last week's episode. We talked to Thomas Frank, and he talks about how there's this assumption on the part of Democrats that people of color and working class of all colors had no place else to go, and that really backfired. Right. And you say, Karina, something really controversial. We're going to have to do a bonus interview with you because we barely got to scratch the surface. But you write in your piece, perhaps this is because the few reforms offered by Barack Obama's administration were just enough to deter mass political mobilization. So we're going to talk about that with you another time. We're going to release it this week. People can go to Facebook, iTunes, SoundCloud to find us. It's the Katie Halper Show on Facebook. Find us on SoundCloud, iTunes. Make sure you rate and review us on iTunes. And we're going to talk to you about that and also the information that's now accessible. Karina Moreno, thank you so much. Where can people find you online?
I'm on Twitter, Kari in Brooklyn, K-A-R-Y in Brooklyn.
Great. And thank you so much again, Randy Bryce, Iron Stash on Twitter and on Facebook, who's going to be challenging Paul Ryan. Don't forget to join our Patreon. That's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show, because then you will be able to hear really great bonus content in which Randy Bryce responds to the CNN gotcha interview that he didn't have enough time to respond to on television because they, of course, ambush you with ridiculous questions. As if that's not good enough, Adam Johnson, extremely smart, knowledgeable media critic, journalist, offers tips on what to do when you're presented with questions like those. So this is extremely useful and extremely insightful. Thank you.
If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.